Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 19th of January. Peter Bergen is our guest this hour. He is the author of The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. Peter is CNN's national security analyst and best-selling author of other books, Holy War, Inc., and The Osama Bin Laden, I Know. He is one of the few journalists who has had a chance to interview Osama bin Laden. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation and NYU's Center on Law and Security. He has written for a number of publications, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, the Wall Street Journal, and Foreign Affairs. And we're trying to pin him down on the phone right now. He writes early in the book that the goal of the book is to tell a history of the war on terror in one volume. The organizing principle of this history is to examine not only the actions and strategies of the U.S. and its key allies, but also those of Al-Qaeda and its allies, such as the Taliban. Most histories have been written largely from an American perspective, while this book folds into the narrative the perspective of Al-Qaeda and allied jihadist groups. Each side, he says, has made a set of symbiotic strategic errors that has helped the other. Luckily, those of the U.S. have not been as profound as Al-Qaeda's, although they certainly have been significant, from ceding the moral high ground with Guantanamo and coercive interrogations to invading Iraq, which gave a new lease on life to the jihadist movement, to almost losing the Afghan war. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Peter. I'm sure we'll have many of them. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Peter.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good.
Good. Thank you so much for being with us. Let's talk about Al-Qaeda. Let's start with Al-Qaeda. And you write about Al-Qaeda's jihad, which has failed to achieve its central aims. What has been bin Laden's primary goal, and how have they not been able to achieve their central aims?
Well, you know, bin Laden, what was the purpose of 9/11? The purpose of 9/11 was to get the United States to, after a crippling blow, to pull out of the Middle East and withdraw its support from the authoritarian regimes in the Middle East that bin Laden seeks to overthrow, so that he can replace them with Taliban-style rule around the region. Now, of course, none of that happened. The United States instead invaded Afghanistan, later invaded and occupied Iraq. Our relations with the authoritarian regimes like the Saudis and the Egyptians are stronger than ever. And so, you know, bin Laden's central war aims with the 9/11 attacks failed. And what looked like a great victory was really, a tactical success. But embedded in that was a larger strategic defeat for Al-Qaeda, because as a result of the attacks, they lost their base in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda means the base in Arabic, and they lost that very good base.
Mm-hmm. Were there discussions about the possible ramifications of the attack on the United States on September 11 among top leadership of Al-Qaeda, including bin Laden, or did they not analyze that?
They did. I mean, you know, I interviewed, there's one person that's mentioned in the book, Libyan who ran an important Libyan affiliate of Al-Qaeda, and he as early as the summer of 2000 told bin Laden in a sort of summit meeting of jihadi leaders that attacking the United States would be quite counterproductive for their main aim, which their main aim was regime change around the Middle East. And similarly, we know from the 9/11 Commission report that other leaders in Al-Qaeda voiced objections to the idea of attacking the United States, either on tactical grounds, we don't want this 800-pound gorilla after us, or on even religious grounds, you know, that attacking civilians in this manner could not be religiously sanctioned. But because bin Laden runs Al-Qaeda very much as a sort of almost in a dictatorial way, his views were far more important than anybody else's views.
Mm-hmm. You spend quite some time in the book outlining, and we know this, but it's good to be reminded of all of these signs there were before September 11 that we needed, and we didn't pay attention to this huge threat that was coming from Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I mean, you know, bin Laden declared war on the United States in an interview with CNN that I produced in 1997. And imagine if the Japanese had started saying in 1937 that we are planning to attack the United States, how the events of Pearl Harbor might have panned out differently. And so we were warned, and leaving aside the question of what secret information was known to the U.S. government, of which there was a great deal, that al-Qaeda was planning something bigger in the summer of 2001 and that it might be directed at the United States. There was a great deal of stuff just that was out there in the open. Bin Laden gave an interview in late June of 2001, he and his top leaders hinting about an impending attack on the United States. Certainly the scuttlebutt in al-Qaeda's training camps in the summer of 2001 was there was a big attack coming. This was widely known to people in the camps. And so, you know, this was sort of an open secret at the time.
Mm-hmm. And the search goes on to try and find this guy. I don't know if we ever will or not, but you write about al-Qaeda being highly secretive, compartmentalized, and security conscious. Are there strategies in place that may work to flush out bin Laden, the bounty that's on his head, and why people still wonder this, why so much time has gone by and we don't know where the guy is? And what if he were caught? Or what if he were killed?
Well, you know, I mean, he's going to be 54 on February 15th, so he's not, you know, he's got plenty of years left in him. Mm. He doesn't suffer from any life-threatening illnesses, and he may die in the comfort of his own bed, which I think would be pretty surprising to most Americans, given the fact that we spent $500 billion on our intelligence, you know, that this guy has just escaped. And, you know, how might we find him? There are several ways people get caught. You mentioned a bounty. Well, there's been a bounty on bin Laden's head since 1999 with no takers. So I don't think that will be particularly effective. He, you know, signals intelligence from cell phone calls or satellite phone calls. Might be one way of finding him, but he's not making those kinds of calls. He may make a mistake. By the law of averages, he's a human, and he will make a mistake at some point. But, you know, it could be a year from now, it could be 10 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And the final, you know, I mean, what people are looking for is there's a general sense he's in the northwest frontier region of Pakistan, in that neighborhood, which is like you know, having a general sense that somebody's in Wyoming. It's not a particularly useful locator, but, you know, I think that you're looking for anomalies that might give him away. He's had a long interest in thoroughbred horses. He was a daily rider, you know, somebody who had some nice thoroughbred horses in some remote part of Pakistan's northwest frontier region. He, you know, he may have visitors who are foreigners, Arabs. These kinds of things is what, those are the kinds of indicators you'd be looking for.
Mm-hmm. Considering the fact that he hasn't been able to achieve his central aims, what feelings are there about him now among former allies or potential allies? Has he lost his clout?
Well, you know, he is certainly losing clout amongst some of his religious mentors and some people who fought with him in Afghanistan who have very publicly turned against him. Mostly on the issue that al-Qaeda and its allies keep killing Muslim civilians. And as a group that positions itself as the defender of true Islam, this is not impressive. But also, I think bin Laden is losing the war of ideas in the wider Muslim world in country after country. Support for al-Qaeda, bin Laden, and suicide bombing is precipitously dropping. It hasn't gone down to zero, which is where you want it to be, but it's certainly not at where it was a few months after 9/11. And that's because in country after country around the Muslim world, al-Qaeda or its allies have killed a lot of Muslim civilians. And so there's a dawning recognition in the Muslim world, and it's been going on for years now, that the same ideological virus that unleashed the 9/11 attacks is also coming back home to haunt citizens of Iraq, of Saudi Arabia, of Indonesia, of Jordan, and country after country where al-Qaeda and its allies have killed a lot of Muslim civilians.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the response in the United States to the attacks and the measures that various administrations have taken since 9/11, the Bush administration, the Obama administration. How many threats have we had since then that have been serious, threats that we don't know about, and the measures that were taken by these administrations to make us safer?
Well, I think the serious threats we know about, because if it's a serious threat, there's almost invariably a criminal proceeding in which an indictment is publicly circulated, and often a trial and often a conviction. So, you know, I don't think there's anything that we the American public, don't know about Al-Qaeda and its, you know, in terms of Al-Qaeda or its allies' attempts to attack the United States since 9/11. I mean, the most threatening potential attack was one I'm sure most listeners remember quite well, which was Christmas Day 2009, when a young Nigerian man smuggled a plastic explosives onto a plane flying from Amsterdam to Detroit and tried to detonate it. And if that plane had gone down, 300 mostly Americans on board would have been killed, along with people on the ground in Detroit. And of course, it would have made great television. That was, of course, one of the reasons that they waited for the plane to be flying over the American mainland. You would have had the pictures of the plane on the ground. It would have been this huge news story. It was a big news story, even when it didn't succeed. So, you know, that was certainly threatening. Najib al-Azazi, who was a guy who lived in Denver, Colorado, who had been trained by al-Qaeda, he traveled to New York around the 8th anniversary of 9/11 to blow up bombs in the Manhattan subway. He had a serious plan. He was capable of building these bombs. That would have been serious if it happened. And finally, Faisal Shahzad, who was trained by the Pakistani Taliban, a former financial analyst at the Elizabeth Arden Cosmetics Company
in
Connecticut. He trained in the tribal regions and came to Times Square on early May 2010 and tried to blow up a SUV on a Saturday night when there'd be as many people as possible that he would try and kill. Mm-hmm. And luckily that didn't work. But all these things, you know, were somewhat threatening. They wouldn't have been 9/11 style events, certainly. And I don't think Al-Qaeda or its affiliates are capable of pulling anything off of that magnitude, but they still retain some capability, even in their much weakened state.
We welcome phone calls for Peter. Here's our phone number if you want to join the conversation. He's written what has been called the most comprehensive history of the war on terror that has yet been written, a definitive assessment of Al-Qaeda and America since 9/11. The book is The Longest War, just published, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. And you know of Peter's work. He is CNN's national security analyst. He's also the author of the best-selling Holy War, Inc., and the Osama bin Laden that I know. He is a fellow at the New America Foundation and New York University's Center on Law and Security and has written for a number of publications. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. He is also one of the few Western journalists ever to have interviewed Osama bin Laden. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Peter Bergen, our guest, his book, which is fascinating and very well documented, is The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. Our phone number again, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and we start our calls with Brad from Milwaukee. Hello, Brad.
Hey, good morning, Joy. I enjoy your program, and thanks for having such a distinguished guest on. Peter, I admire your work and your bravery.
Oh, thank you.
Say, I would, if you had the opportunity to run the United States Army, military, do you think that the strategy that they have implemented is an effective way to go after bin Laden, or is there other options in your mind that would be more effective? I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Again, I really admire your work.
Thanks, Brad, for the call.
You know, I think, you know, the history of manhunts is littered with cases where, you know, the man is not found, or it takes a long time. I mean, so I don't want to underestimate the difficulty of doing this. If you look at the, Karadzic, who was the, you know, alleged war criminal in Serbia, it took him. Took 12 years to hunt him down in a small European country where he was living more or less openly. The United States had 20,000 troops looking for the Somali warlord, Mohamed Aidid, in Mogadishu in 1993 and never found him. The Israelis spent 15 years looking for Eichmann and finally found him in Latin America. on the other hand, the angel of death, Dr. Mengele, who had was one of the leading Nazi war criminals, died in Brazil in the 1970s and was never found. So, you know, finding people is not easy, and you know, doesn't necessarily require a military solution. This requires as much of a, it's really about intelligence. And I know that there are people in the U.S. government who get up every morning whose job it is to think about how to find bin Laden. But, you know, if you're not making the kinds of mistakes that give your position away, it's pretty hard. If you hunker down, if you have a hardcore of people around you who will not drop a dime on you for a cash reward, there's kind of a limit to what you can do. And there's certainly a limit to what the U.S. military can do in Pakistan, because the Pakistanis have made it very clear that, you know, large numbers of American boots on the ground is a red line for them that they will not allow to happen.
Mm-hmm. What about American boots on the ground in Afghanistan? Let's spend some time. A lot of our perception in this country is that it's a corrupt government and we shouldn't be there. You know the criticism here. It's long been a graveyard of empires, and you say a graveyard of empires metaphor belonged in the graveyard of cliches. Give us a more layered understanding of our role in Afghanistan and what the possibilities are of building a nation there.
Well, I think, you know, the first point to make is that the idea that Afghanistan doesn't have a sense of nationhood is ridiculous. The first Afghan modern state arose in 1747. And so, Afghanistan has been a nation state longer than the United States or even Italy and Germany, which were only united in the late 19th century. Afghans have a sense of nationhood. What they have never had is a strong central state. And one of the problems, I think, in the way that the Afghan government is presently constituted is that much of the power is concentrated in the president, who can appoint all the governors and sub-governors, and really the country is much more attuned to local governance and local leaders, and hopefully we'll move more in that direction over time. Certainly the Karzai government is corrupt, but let's look at the neighborhood he lives in. On one side he's got Iran, which is Ahmadinejad, the Holocaust denier. To his north you have Uzbekistan, Karimov, the leader there, boils people alive. Mm. You know, in Pakistan, you've had four military dictatorships in the last 60 years. It's not an area where there's been perfect leaders, and I think by regional standards, he's pretty much not that bad. And also by Afghan historical standards, if you go back the last 30 years, you've had the Soviets controlling the country, then you had a communist puppet dictator, Najibullah, then you had warlords running the country, then you had the Taliban. By those standards, Karzai is looking much better, and I think that, you know, I've been visiting Afghanistan since 1993, and I've seen what the civil war looked like. I was there under the Taliban. I mean, what is happening in Afghanistan today is orders of magnitude better. We all know what the problems are, but let's just look at some of the things that are going well. You've got millions of girls in schools. You've got an economy that is growing from a very, very low point. You've got one in four Afghans have cell phones. Kabul, the capital, is jammed with traffic and businesses that didn't exist at all under the Taliban. And Afghans themselves still have a favorable view of international forces. The majority of them want us to stay, not to leave. They want us to kind of perform on our promises. And, they're optimistic about the future because they know that what is happening now, while it's not far from perfect, is better than anything they've had to deal with in the last 30 years.
And, Peter, how long do you think we'll be there?
I think we're going to be there for as long as we're in South Korea, you know, 60 years after the end of the Korean War.
Really? You think we're going to be there that long?
Well, we were attacked from there. I mean, we're in all sorts of countries. We're in Okinawa, you know, right. Decades after the end of World War II. We're in Germany still, to some degree. We're in the United Kingdom. I mean, the United States, once it sort of puts bases down, that doesn't tend to sort of walk away. And I think in the case of Afghanistan, the Afghan government would like us to stay. I mean, the next thing that will happen there, I think, is that the Afghan government will seek some sort of status of forces agreement with the United States and vice versa, which puts this on a more permanent footing. I'm not saying necessarily it will be a large-scale military presence, but certainly bases. Afghans remember very well that we closed our embassy in 1989 and the country quickly fell into civil war. And we had no understanding of what that civil war, because we had no eyes on the ground, we didn't understand what was going on, and the civil war then threw up the Taliban, and again, we had nobody on the ground. We didn't really understand that phenomenon. The Taliban then brought al-Qaeda. They gave refuge to al-Qaeda. So, you know, we don't want to make the same set of mistakes in Afghanistan that we've already made, which is to wash our hands of the place. And the Afghans don't want us to do that either.
Mm-hmm. You described earlier policies as being Afghanistan on the cheap approach.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the Bush administration and the media post 9/11 era was kind of a victim of their own success. The quick overthrow of the Taliban with a very small number of American soldiers on the ground led them to believe that a small number of American soldiers was desirable to keep the peace there, and that turned out to be completely wrong. And then, you know, they were ideologically opposed to nation building, and therefore they did nothing to really to build up the Afghan National Army or the Afghan state. And, you know, over time, a vacuum of governance and a vacuum of security allowed the Taliban an opportunity. And so by 2005, you begin to see the Taliban coming back.
Let's go to Armando from Galena, Illinois. Hi, Armando.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for your program. My comment is about the white elephant in the room. It's like, you know, we say this war has lasted so long and all these things, but one thing that we haven't recognized or that nobody wants to talk about, you know, even President Carter, when he tried to talk about, you know, he was shut off, is about the Palestinian issue. Osama bin Laden, when after 9/11, I don't know through what means of communication, he let us know that as long as the West Bank is occupied by the Israelis, and also that he talked about other Arab lands being occupied, I think he was talking about, you know, maybe the oil fields or whatever, you know, there's going to be a war with these people. And it's like, why don't we talk about it? Why is that the Palestinian issue is not being solved after so many years? That's my comment.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. And you write about the importance of this issue to bin Laden in your book as well.
Right. I mean, this is a central issue, not just for bin Laden, but for many Muslims who will never attack the United States and may even have a somewhat, you know, warm view of the United States. Just because bin Laden attacked us on 9/11 doesn't mean that somehow we should change all our foreign policy just because he's attacked us on that basis. But we should take a more even-handed approach on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Historically, we've tended not to, just as a, you know, because it's the right thing to do. Nothing to do with bin Laden, you know, it is a widely held view in the Muslim world that we do not take an even-handed approach to this issue. And I think if it was seen that we were taking such an approach, I think that would be helpful. And I, you know, that goes well beyond the issue of why bin Laden attacked us. It's really more about trying to lower the temperature in the Muslim world. This, of course, would be a very useful thing.
Mm-hmm. An email from Phil in Hebron. Do you think that there are government agencies that know bin Laden's location? Is there someone who can be bribed to reveal his location, perhaps the Pakistan Intelligence Service, and why has this not been done?
I don't think the Pakistanis know where bin Laden is. I don't think that they have any great appetite to try and find him, because he still retains quite some popularity in certain quarters of Pakistan. But, you know, I don't think they know where he is. And there is a $25 million reward, so, you know, bin Laden's not revealing his presence to anybody but a very limited circle, because there would be people, obviously, who'd be quite willing to pick up that reward. In fact, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the operational commander of 9/11, was picked up in Pakistan in 2003, and somebody involved in that, the informant, was paid $25 million.
We go next to Chris in Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
Hi. The question is, would there be more results if the bounty on bin Laden was up to, say, a few hundred million? And I'll listen off the air.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's been some discussion of making it larger, but there's a few problems with that. One is you don't want to try and make bin Laden more important than he is already by signaling, you know, several hundred million dollar reward. In a way, that would be a psychological victory for him. You know, it might make, on the other hand, it may well make it easier to find him. But you know, the rewards for bin Laden have consistently gone up. They started at $2 million in 1999, and they've gone up, significantly since. So, you know, I just think there's a limited universe of people know where he is, and they believe that bin Laden is a true warrior for Islam, and they're not going to reveal his location.
We talked about the threats that we've faced in the United States since 9/11. Let's talk about the United Kingdom for a moment. No Western country, you write, more threatened by al-Qaeda than United Kingdom. As many as 2,000 citizens, British intelligence identified in 2009, who posed a serious threat to security. Why are they so active in the United Kingdom?
Part of it is sort of an accident of geography. Al-Qaeda is headquartered in the tribal regions of Pakistan. 70% of British Muslims are Pakistanis. 400,000 British citizens go back to Pakistan every year for family vacations. So there's a great deal of back and forth. And it only requires a very small minority of those 400,000 to hook up with some militant group in Pakistan, which often will lead them into the arms of al-Qaeda. And you've got a problem. And certainly Britain has had a big problem. The problem is, I think, is got a little bit better in the recent years because there have been a number of cases that have been, a number of sort of terrorist groups have been broken up inside the United Kingdom, and the British police and intelligence service have a pretty effective and aggressive efforts against these guys. But it's really the Pakistan pipeline that is part of the story here in terms of al-Qaeda's ability to recruit people in the United Kingdom.
Mm-hmm. We welcome more phone calls if you'd like to join the conversation with Peter Bergen. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Let's talk a little more about the strategic errors the United States may have made. Can you discuss the reaction to Guantanamo and the reaction to it's very, very tough interrogation, waterboarding, et cetera, at Abu Ghraib?
Well, there was the waterboarding didn't happen at Abu Ghraib, of course, but Abu Ghraib was also a propaganda victory for al-Qaeda and allied groups. I think that, these coercive interrogations, Guantanamo, I mean, apart from anything else, they said to the Muslim world, the Bush administration keeps preaching the virtues of human rights and democracy, yet is hypocritically reserving the rights to ignore those human rights when it suits its own purposes. And hypocrisy is never a very powerful. It's not attractive. And so, at Guantanamo, I think some of the people I interviewed in the book, FBI special agents, said that most of the information coming out of Guantanamo wasn't especially useful. And, of course, balanced against that was the fact that for many years there, the inmates didn't have lawyers and were denied habeas corpus and the like. And, of course, the Supreme Court eventually ruled against the Bush administration on that issue. And eventually we found out who was in the prison, and they began to have lawyers. And there have even been some trials, although very, very few of the prisoners there. Most of them have now been returned to their home countries. On the coercive interrogations, the people who are most opposed to that kind of thing are federal prosecutors and FBI agents who, their bread and butter is understanding that, a useful interrogation is not a coerced one. It's not necessary. It's counterproductive often. It's also un-American. And again, those kinds of coercive interrogations were reversed by rulings of the Supreme Court, giving the prisoners involved, the protections of the Geneva Convention.
And the waterboarding, was it Khalid Sheikh Mohammed who was waterboarded? Do we know if we got any information from him as a result of that?
Yeah, he was waterboarded 183 times. The waterboarding definitely works. People are more likely to tell you things. But the question is, what did it really reveal? And I think in Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's case, certainly he revealed information that led to the arrest of an al-Qaeda leader in Southeast Asia. and some of his compatriots. He also revealed the presence of a guy called Ayman Faris, a Ohio truck driver who had a harebrained scheme to bring down the Brooklyn Bridge with a pair of gas cutters. He was a member of Al-Qaeda, living in the United States with some plan, even if harebrained, to attack it. But, you know, balanced against that, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed gave up a lot of information, which was really just about terrorist plots that were sort of just talk. There was no indication that they were real. And I think that, you know, you have to balance the fact that there are other ways to get information from prisoners, including when you arrest them, they usually have computers which have information. They have cell phones. They have confederates that you can sort of cross-reference things with. And, I think that ceding the moral high ground with these kinds of techniques, it didn't make America safer. That was a claim of certainly Vice President Cheney. I don't think that, you know, even I quote at one point FBI Director Robert Mueller, who was asked directly, was there any of these coercive interrogations, did they ever, you know, stop a plot against us, the United States? And he says no. And by the way, that was similarly the conclusion of the CIA Inspector General, who found that none of the information that was given up during the coercive interrogations, diverted some plot of any significance or imminence.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Patricia in Brookfield. Hi, Patricia.
Hi. The guest said that the Bush administration was opposed to nation building. And I have heard President Obama repeatedly say that he is also opposed to nation building in Afghanistan. But I would be very much for nation building there, and I'm wondering if your guest foresees some sort of change in direction in the current administration's view on that.
Sure. Well, you know, I think the term nation building is one of those things that, the President Obama may have said that he's opposed to nation building, but, you know, what are we actually doing in Afghanistan? We've got 100,000 men and women in uniform. We're spending $100 billion a year. We're trying to create an Afghan national army that could be as large as 400,000 men. We're trying to stand up an Afghan judicial system that actually works. We're trying to, you know, support in a myriad of different ways the very nascent Afghan state. I mean, we can say that we're not doing nation building, but really we are. And certainly this is very different from what we did in the sort of 2003, 2004 time frame, when there were 6,000 American soldiers in Afghanistan only, which is the size of the police force in Houston in a country the size of Texas with a population 10 times larger than Houston. And we were, you know, spending almost no money at all, relatively speaking, and giving it very little attention. So while President Obama may say that he's opposed to a nation building, the fact is that we're doing something much more substantial now in Afghanistan than we've done before, and I think that's the right thing to do, because our exit strategy at the end of the day is an Afghan national army that can kind of operate on its own, secure much of the country, and that's what we're trying to build.
Could we talk a little bit more about the war of ideas and how a significant change of administration in the United States with the election of Obama, who spoke to the Muslim world quite movingly a couple of years ago, has changed what's being discussed in the war of ideas? Has it changed the image of the United States in any substantial way?
Well, you know, I think the idea that the United States was going to win the war of ideas against Al-Qaeda was always a very naive one. I mean, what we really need is not people to necessarily love the United States. There are lots of allies that we have where there's a fair amount of anti-American sentiment. Just look at France, for instance. Yet France has probably the largest CIA station in Europe. So, you know, anti-Americanism is not the problem. It's because that, you know, is the world's only superpower. That's bound to happen. The real problem is people having a positive view of Al-Qaeda and willing to take up arms. And luckily that pool of people is really decreasing. In poll after poll around the Muslim world, we've seen that bin Laden's ideas, Al-Qaeda suicide, support for suicide bombing is really, you know, evaporating. And that's really the important war of ideas, is for people to turn against Al-Qaeda and its allies. Just as it was, you know, it wasn't so much that the Soviet Union collapsed because everybody thought the United States was the world's greatest power. It was more because people began to realize that the ideas at the center of the Soviet Union were bankrupt.
Mm-hmm. And there's nobody, he's been in hiding for so long, there's nobody who's taking over with a slightly different philosophy that's appealing to a lot of people?
You know, I don't think so. You know, Al-Qaeda is very much an organization totally dominated by bin Laden. When you join Al-Qaeda, you don't swear an oath of allegiance to the organization. You swear an oath of allegiance to bin Laden himself. And, you know, comparisons with, I don't want to make a direct comparison with Nazism, except the following, which is that when you joined the Nazi party, you didn't swear an oath of allegiance to Nazism. You swore an oath of allegiance to Adolf Hitler. And so these organizations are similar in the sense that they're led by charismatic leaders, and there is no other sort of competing voice. I mean, it's Ayman al-Zawahiri, bin Laden's number two, does come out with videotapes and audio tapes. He's a smart guy, but he's obviously not the leader of this organization.
More phone calls in a moment. Peter Bergen is our guest. His book, The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda, has just been published. Peter has become really the country's expert on terrorism and the war against terror even before that. He's traced the whole history, but this book concentrates on what's happened since 9/11 in fighting the war on terror. He is CNN's national security analyst and the best-selling author of Holy War, Incorporated, and The Osama Bin Laden I Know. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation and NYU's Center on Law and Security, and has written for a number of prominent publications. One line is open if you'd like to join our conversation. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to phone calls for Peter Bergen. Our next caller is Dennis in Toma. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning. How are you all today?
Fine, Dennis. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good.
My comment or question is, at the very beginning when the hunt for bin Laden began, I had heard that he needed to be on a dialysis machine quite often. If that would be the case, you would think that it would be a lot easier to pinpoint as to where he is. I'll listen to your comments off the air.
Thanks, Dennis.
Yeah, I mean, that reporting turned out to be wishful thinking. He's not on a dialysis machine, and, you know, we've seen him in the last time we saw a videotape of bin Laden was in 2007, and he looked better than he'd looked for in years. He, you know, his clothes were pressed. He had dyed his beard black, suggesting that as he kind of rounded into his fifth decade, he was not immune to some personal vanity. And he looked fine. So, you know, he's not suffering from some kind of major life-threatening illness, particularly kidney disease. And in fact, his son, Omar bin Laden, came out with a book a couple of years ago, a very interesting book that he co-wrote with his mother, bin Laden's first wife. And he says that the kidney dialysis story originated with the fact that his father suffered from kidney stones, which is a whole different kind of medical affliction.
Huh. And that was so widely believed by so many people, and still is, obviously.
Right. But, you know, part of it is just like, you know, the reporting on bin Laden tends to be, a lot of it is quite sensational, partly because you can't libel him. It's not like you can do a fact check with him about what you're saying. So you can just, a lot of people just write any old stuff that occurs to them.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say a lot, that's wrong, but I mean, there's been a lot of stuff that just is simply not true. I attempted in both this book and in earlier books to try and nail down as much real information about him as possible, and that's not impossible. I mean, he has friends who know him. He has family members. He's got 53 siblings. He's got several hundred, cousins, because his dad had 20 kids. 53 kids, including bin Laden. His father had 20 wives. Bin Laden releases lots of videotapes and audio tapes that you can kind of analyze. Other people in his circle continue to publish information on the internet. So, Yeah, there is a stuff out there that is reliable information that you can kind of piece together real information about him.
Let's go to Charles in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Charles.
Yes, I'd like your guest's view of our government's increasing use of drones and ramming up the use of military force and aggression. And will that really be a successful, have a overall successful effect, either on the war or on our effect on the Middle East?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting question. President Obama has authorized four times more drone strikes into Pakistan than George W. Bush did in his 8 years in office. So this is one of many continuities between the Obama administration and the Bush administration. In fact, it's not only a continuity. The Obama administration has taken this policy and amped it up dramatically. The big question is, how many civilian casualties are there? And a colleague of mine at the New America Foundation, where I work, maintains a very detailed database of this issue, which you can find on the New America website. Every drone strike that is reported by quality media, we average out the figures and try and work out how many militants died, how many non-militants died. What's interesting is the civilian casualty death rate, according to these reports over time, has declined from circa 25% early on in the program down to about 6%. And there's a lot more information that any interested listener can find on the website about who's been killed. The number of leaders of the groups that have been killed is pretty small, maybe 2% of the total, but certainly this is having some interruptive effect on al-Qaeda, the Pakistani Taliban, and allied groups in this region. But it's not a panacea. I mean, Westerners continue to travel to this area to get some form of training. Clearly, some of the people involved in these attacks or these attempted attacks in the West are going to other parts of Pakistan because the heat is on in the tribal regions of Pakistan. All these drone strikes have been in the tribal regions of Pakistan. They haven't been in other areas of Pakistan. I don't think they ever will be. So, but the reason that these attacks happen at all is because the United States can't send ground troops, does have better intelligence about where members of these militant groups are living, and is using this tool, as Leon Panetta, the head of the CIA, has said in the past, this is the only game in town. So they're using this because they don't have any other options. I think that, and clearly, they are worried about civilian casualties. U.S. officials privately say that the civilian casualty rate is now zero or close to it. Since the program is highly secret and classified, it's hard to assess how true that is, except the way that we have done it through published reports of these attacks as they happen.
Peter, tell us again how you were able to secure an interview with bin Laden, when that happened, and how scared. You're a pretty fearless guy, so maybe you weren't scared at all, but how did you secure that interview?
Well, it took some doing. I mean, back in 97, bin Laden was paranoid, secretive, disciplined, so were the people around him. So it took some weeks of negotiation with his friends and colleagues, some of whom were based in London, and we went into Pakistan with a couple of his colleagues, traveled into Afghanistan, then controlled by the Taliban. And, the whole process was lengthy and tortuous. We didn't think it was particularly dangerous. After all, this was their first television interview. They were hardly going to, interfere with their first television interview by doing something to us that we would come to regret. It was hard to predict then that, all the things that have flown from him since would have happened. I mean, it was hard to predict that he would attack the United States. He announced that he was planning to attack the United States during the course of that interview. At the back of my mind, it was, he's sitting in Afghanistan in a mud hut in the middle of the night. How do you actually implement an attack
right.
on the United States?
It's I'm sure hard. You thought that.
But, the answer came a year later in 98 mm-hmm. when he blew up two U.S. embassies within nine minutes of each other in Africa. Pretty hard thing to do, and then he attacked the USS Cole. There was a pattern here.
Mm-hmm. Charles, thanks for the call. We go to Jess in Madison. Hi.
Yes, good morning. I was in Afghanistan in December for a couple weeks, and it was to do some training with a humanitarian organization there. Very bright, educated Afghan people. The director of the organization had been a Fulbright scholar here, really top-notch people. And I asked everybody, not that it had anything to do with my work, but just curiosity, obviously, I asked everybody, what's the difference if we all pull out, the NATO forces and U.S. forces in particular, pull out tomorrow or 5 years from tomorrow? What's the difference? And what's the difference between the day after that tomorrow or 5 years from that day? They were all dreading the day when we do pull out. I was surprised to find I didn't talk to anyone who said, get them out now, although I was talking to the minority of educated, literate people in Afghanistan. 70% are not. But I just no one had an answer to that question. Absolutely no one. And I'm just wondering, you know, focus on bin Laden, fine, sure, but suppose he disappears or someone gets him or he quits or he's killed or whatever. How does that change the situation there? People told me the Taliban, it's akin to the Viet Cong in Vietnam. They're Taliban at night and they're just people you see on the road in the daytime. I just came back extremely confused. I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, look, I mean, I think the caller is making a lot of very, very good points. I mean, it's a confusing place, and I think people who have strongly held views that we should be getting out generally have spent no time there and haven't spoken to any Afghans, because as the caller is pointing out, Afghans are quite worried. They were very worried that we were going to leave in July 2011. There's been a huge sigh of relief now. President Obama has said, you know, we're going to be there till December 2014, and I think this is one of the most underreported or under-processed presidential decisions in a long time. I mean, I'm sure anybody listening to this recalls all the news stories about Obama's decision to send more troops, the 10 meetings he had in the fall of 2009, in which they had a very long, you know, and very careful process about what kind of strategy and level of troops should go to Afghanistan. But this December 2014 is actually a much more important decision. It's because we're putting 4 more years on the clock in Afghanistan. You can do a lot in 4 more years with the right resources and the right strategy. And so, you know, I think Afghans are pretty worried about our leaving. And this is, as the caller says, this has nothing to do with bin Laden. For them, bin Laden is, you know, they could care less at this point. Bin Laden, they know that bin Laden isn't in the country. They're just very concerned about the return of the Taliban, and they know what that looks like. You know, only, you know, in poll after poll, only 7% of Afghans have a favorable view of the Taliban. There's nothing quite like living under the Taliban to have very little nostalgia for their incompetent, brutal, and autocratic rule. And so they are worried about the return of the Taliban. And they're also very worried, by the way, about a civil war reigniting. And so the other advantage, good thing about this 4 years on the clock is, A, the Afghan National Army can be built up to be a significant force that can deal with the Taliban or any other armed group. And two, you know, you're going to allow perhaps political changes to happen so that you can get some successor to Hamid Karzai, whose presidential term will expire in 2014. And so you allow the political process a little bit more breathing room. So, you know, I think that was the right decision. And certainly most Afghans, you know, I think it's the right decision. They're very concerned about the idea of us just leaving.
Let's go to one more call. We have about a minute left. Steve in Marinette. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. A little earlier you said that you didn't think bin Laden had succeeded in everything he wanted to do and was maybe losing some support, but I think he's gone far beyond what he ever thought he would have done by getting the United States and its allies to spend billions, if not trillions, of dollars on two wars and security that has changed our way of life. If you go through an airport, it's because of him and what he's done.
Peter, we have about 30 seconds.
Okay, well, you know, yes, of course he's made some changes. I mean, I don't think he's, you know, the fact that we spend more time at the airport is not an existential threat to our existence. The two wars that we're engaged in total U.S. defense spending is about 4.5% right now. We're spending 1% of GDP in Afghanistan. During the Vietnam War, by comparison, we spent 10% of GDP. So these guys aren't economists. If they think they can bleed us dry, they don't really have much of a real sense of the scale of the American economy.
And thanks to you for the call. Peter, thanks for all of your work and your expertise.
Thank
in
you so much.
The book. Thanks. Peter Bergen, his latest book is The Longest War, The Enduring Conflict Between America and Al-Qaeda. Lawrence Wright says, when the war on terror is consigned to the history books, one name that will dominate as the steady, clear-eyed chronicler of that period is Peter Bergen, among the first to note the rise of Al-Qaeda, and he is still on the case. The book has just been published. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for doing on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls, everybody. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9:00.